You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
And after talking about New Zealand becoming a republic, I was thinking of areas in New Zealand where colonial structures and culture are still very present in day-to-day lives. The New Zealand Defence Force came to mind, and I wanted to explore the dichotomy between the almost post-colonial day-to-day Aotearoa with more traditional day-to-day life in the New Zealand Defence Force. So I spoke to Terry Johansson. He's a lecturer at the Centre for Defence and Security Studies at Massey University about this. And I started off by asking him about the role of the British sovereign for the New Zealand Defence Force.
The sovereign holds a sort of similar position specifically for the Defence Force as it does within the government or the executive branch of the country. So where the Governor-General is the representative of the sovereign here and the Queen is seen as head of state, likewise for the New Zealand Defence Force, you have the Queen being seen as the Commander-in-Chief. However, under the Defence Act of 1990, a lot of the onus for decision-making around defence goes on the Governor-General and the Minister of Defence appointed by the government.
Also, there's a big colonial history with our New Zealand Defence Force. It was first kind of came from Imperial Forces and then a colonial defence force. How does this sort of structure, I suppose it influences the way that our government acts, but also how does it influence the way our New Zealand Defence Force operates?
There's sort of two colonial influences, as you sort of said. Like you've said, that it influences the government's decision-making around defence and how the Defence Force operates, but also the subculture of the military itself has its own. So what they term the profession of arms, so like any profession, doctors, lawyers, the like, they set standards and norms of behaviour and institutions that guide behaviour and describe what it looks like to be a member of that profession. And the military is no different. The real origins of the Western military profession sort of come from that European mass around and how those states sort of came about after the 30 Years' War, and then from there, it sort of evolved. The character of it has evolved, but it still remains around state sovereignty, and the state has the right to protect itself from any other state. And building a defence force or building armed forces is the way the state does that. When New Zealand was created, firstly as a colony and then as a dominion, it simply adopted the British model of a defence force and how it operates. And in some ways, we still continue to sort of follow that model today. In some ways, because we're of our size, because the NZDF is so small, it won't spend a lot of resources on building like doctrine and technology from scratch. It will utilise its allies' experiences and doctrine and guidance for itself if it suits the specific purposes that New Zealand's trying to achieve.
I suppose I'm quite interested in how you were saying that behaviour is guided, because, I mean, the members of the New Zealand Defence Force, they swear allegiance to the Queen, they salute the Queen every time they pass an officer when in uniform. There's daily ceremonies to say good morning and good night to the Queen, such as colours and sunset. And I'm wondering how, like, this kind of behaviour and culture seems a little bit at odds with the rest of New Zealand. What do you kind of think is this dichotomy?
It could be unrelated to the Queen herself and the monarchy. So for the Western model of militaries, there are sort of five fundamental things, five core principles that sort of define that. The first one is discipline, and that's where you see that, you know, what we traditionally understand with the whole discipline, you're seeing parades, that sort of thing. You're seeing an enduring military tradition. You look at a strong industrial base, an aggressive military approach, and I always forget the fifth one. But the one we're primarily talking about is the military tradition. So those rituals You know, there are even more nuanced ones, like at a formal dinner, when passing the port after for the toast at the end of the formal dinner, you may only pass it with your right hand, and the decanter is not to touch the table at all until the pour is finished or it's been passed to the next person. And that comes from, you know, there was apparently a dinner when the Scots and the English had, and the Scots were passing the decanter, and the English pulled out their swords and started a fight with them. So, you know, there's sort of funny little traditions, and I think that's about this creating the whole binding to the military ethos and culture. People tell you, like, if you join the military, you go to basic training, and they're trying to remove your individualism and make it that the team has primacy, so you're just part of a team. And then slowly, as your career progresses, it's making the individual a better component of the team. So there's that military tradition side that really sort of drives those odd sort of looking sort of traditions that we have in the military. And you see them, though, a lot of them, particularly the Commonwealth ones, are universal. If a commissioned officer from the New Zealand Defence Force wants to join the Australian or Canadian or the United Kingdom forces, they can do so because the commission is to the Queen, to the British Crown, then it's seen as comparable with that nation's already standards of behaviour amongst the military there.
I suppose I'm curious about the importance of these traditions today in modern Aotearoa, and if they, you know, if it's important to keep them going as long-standing traditions, or if they should be analysed.
It's part of the cultural heritage, I think. And I know very much the New Zealand Defence Force, they are taken with a grain of salt. Yes, they are part of the organisation's history, but also New Zealand Defence Force, from my experience, is one of the best organisations for incorporating tikanga Māori into the organisation, and it's like an effective combination of the two cultures, Māori culture and the British military culture that is used in there. I know that the New Zealand Defence Force embraces that when it deploys overseas. Regardless of whether it's on an operational deployment or an exercise with allied partners and the like, there will always be elements of tikanga Māori that are present in, as part of the deployment. I noticed in my time in Afghanistan, it was always when we got important visitors, they were greeted by a wero, and a lot of the tikanga Māori was introduced to how we hosted people there. You know, most units have their own haka, so, you know, it's not just that everyone pulls out tamati and does it. You know, they are the army haka in itself is done performed with campaign on. So, you know, there are this melding of cultures, but in the operational side, I think the NZDF has realised the advantage that we get by combining the best of both. Cultures, professional military culture and Māori culture, and I think some of the perceptions or some of the understandings of our performance on operations comes down to this acknowledgement of Māori and the relationship with Māori within the Defence Force, and how that can actually make the organisation better, particularly doing operations in places like East Timor and Afghanistan, Solomon Islands, where the people there are tribal culture, much like Māori, so it gives a greater understanding of those people's needs and how that sort of works. So, yeah, the combining of the cultures in the New Zealand model allows for us to have that operational success.
Certainly sounds like they've come a long way. I suppose the traditions and the ceremonies cost a bit of money to do and to maintain, and how do we value the, like, monetary value on, like, continuing these ceremonies?
Which ceremonies specifically are you talking about?
I suppose just, you know, the use of personnel to travel up and down the country to go to different parades and ceremonies and things like that, year in, year out. It does cost the Defence Force a bit of money, and I suppose I was wondering about how we quantify that.
It's not even the money value, it's the amount of training time you can lose. For example, in my career, I was in the artillery regiment, and whenever a head of state would visit, there was a 21-gun salute required in Wellington. And this is fine when you had a reservist artillery unit down there, but one year I prepared some data because it worked out that within the first 6 months of the year, that artillery unit, because New Zealand only has one, would lose a month of training time in the first 6 months of the year because of the different ceremonial requirements it needed to do to go down into Wellington, the rehearsals, the preparations and the like. So it lost a lot of time doing that. So as for other types of these larger parades and the like, personnel ones is not a big cost. And usually if you're having parades involving a lot of personnel, they're taken from that immediate region. It may be, you know, VIPs that are flying in. Where possible, they use the Air Force, which has training value as well. It's not just the cost of the plane, but, you know, the crew need flying hours as part of their competencies. So, and then you've got the whole ground crew that's preparing and receiving the aircraft at the end. So there is actually residual training value that sort of goes with some of those movements around the country for those parades.
And just finally, I'd kind of like to talk hypothetically about how the New Zealand Defence Force would change if New Zealand became a republic.
Not much. again, look, we work with the Americans and they have their intricacies, but they work to the president. They don't work to the Queen. They still have a lot of the same traditions because if you look at, I've done some research around militaries around the world and 90% of them look the same, even though states are all very different. Another academic in Australia, Theo Farrell, he talks about global isomorphism, where these principles of what a military looks like and what it should do and what it shouldn't do, you know, universally passed, and people want to be in the club, so they conform to some of these procedures. So you would see, in my opinion, that if we change the head of state to be a president instead of the Queen, you know, we wouldn't see much change procedurally and operationally. Because again, I might have complained about the heads of state, but receiving 21-gun salutes, but that's what they expect. And so there are some things that would need to be kept in that ceremonial realm.
That was Massey University lecturer Terry Johansson about the colonial structure of the New Zealand Defence Force.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.